Welcome to It's Our Money with Ellen Brown, a look behind the curtain of global finance and monetary control with one of the top experts in the field. Author of the bestseller Web of Debt and the Public Bank Solution, Ellen Brown's pioneering research started the national movement to create new American public banks. We'll look at developments in the banking industry, economics, and money itself, and we'll update you on developments on the public banking frontier. Our program is underwritten by Payment Management Merchant Credit Card Services at paymentmgmt.com.
You are an old man who thinks in terms of nations and peoples. There are no nations. There are no peoples. There are no Russians. There are no Arabs. There are no third worlds. There is no West. There is only one holistic system of systems. One vast and immane, interwoven, interacting, multivariate, multinational dominion of dollars. It is the international system of currency which determines the totality of life on this planet. That is the atomic structure of things today. There is no America. There is no democracy. There is only IBM and ITT and AT&T and DuPont, Dow, Union Carbide, and Exxon. Those are the nations of the world today. The world is a college of corporations, inexorably determined by the immutable bylaws of business. The world is a business, Mr. Beale.
I don't have to tell you things are bad. Everybody knows things are bad. It's a depression. Everybody's out of work or scared of losing their job. The dollar buys a nickel's worth. Banks are going bust. Shopkeepers keep a gun under the counter. We know the air is unfit to breathe and our food is unfit to eat. We sit watching our TVs while some local newscaster tells us that today we had 15 homicides and 63 violent crimes, as if that's the way it's supposed to be. We know things are bad, worse than bad. They're crazy. We sit in the house and slowly the world we're living in is getting smaller, and all we say is, please, at least leave us alone in our living rooms. Let me have my toaster and my TV and my steel-belted radios and I won't say anything. Just leave us alone. Well, I'm not going to leave you alone. I want you to get mad. You've got to get mad. You've got to say, I'm a human being. God damn it. My life has value. I want all of you to get up out of your chairs. I want you to get up right now and go to the window, open it, and stick your head out and yell, I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore.
That prescient bit of expression by TV anchorman Howard Beale in the film Network comes from 1976, with comments at the start from one of the gods of the oligarchy who described in clear terms how the world is ordered. It's a piece that we feel fits more accurately today than ever, following a momentous development in Congress this past week of procedural approval for the Trans-Pacific Partnership, despite an unprecedented outpouring of public opposition. Welcome to It's Our Money. I'm Walt McCree, and on today's program, we're hoping to get you stirred up enough to go to your virtual window, open it, and shout out your demand to be treated as a human being rather than a corporate pawn, as an American citizen with rights and a voice rather than a neo-feudal consumer relegated to the tides and the masters of the marketplace. Ellen's guest this week is one of the key leaders of the national resistance to the TPP, Kevin Zeese, who will describe for you what this outrageous bit of legislative treachery means for our country and for our economy. But we'll also touch on other aspects of this week's news around money, including a conversation with Chuck Watts of the Empathy Surplus Project and his thoughts about the new papal encyclical that calls for humanity to reconsider its mindless attachments to the financial markets, which are devastating so much of the planet. And Matt Stannard considers what a big bank like Wells Fargo, which has taken a bold stand in support of some human rights, actually reaps from a social justice perspective when it extracts resources from communities and individuals. So let's get started with It's Our Money and join Ellen in her conversation with Kevin Zeese on this week's developments in Washington.
today is Kevin Zeese of the group Popular Resistance and a leader in the Stop Fast Chat Coalition. Great to talk to you, Kevin.
Thanks for having me on. Glad to talk to you, too.
So Popular Resistance, your movement, helped to bring about a landslide vote against Fast Track in the House, which we were all very excited about. And then last week, it all got reversed. Can you tell us what happened and how they pulled that off?
Yeah, it's quite a process. There's been a populist revolt against Fast Track for these Obama trade agreements crossing the political spectrum from right to left. And this House received tens of thousands of phone calls every day for about 2 weeks, hundreds of thousands of phone calls in total opposing Fast Track. And as a result, we had a landslide victory on June 12th against half of the Obama trade package. The Obama trade package is divided in two parts, the Trade Promotion Authority and Trade Adjustment Assistance. It was one bill, so both parts had to pass in order for the bill to succeed. On the vote on the Trade Adjustment Assistance, which is basically support for workers who lose their jobs because of trade, we won with 302 people voting in our favor. It was a massive, amazing landslide victory. They immediately took a second vote, which people at the time perceived as just a symbolic vote, and with 218 votes, they succeeded in passing Trade Promotion Authority. 218 is the magic number in the House for a majority. Immediately after those votes, Representative Boehner called for a revote, and that normally happens within 2 days, two legislative days. But instead, on the second day, they put forward a motion to allow the revote to go until July 30th, the end of July, giving them a lot of time to figure out how to get out of the mess they've gotten themselves into. And what they decided to do was to divide the TPA, the Trade Promotion Authority, which is Fast Track, and the Trade Adjustment Assistance for workers into two separate bills. And they were going to, rather than having a revote on Trade Adjustment Assistance, which is what Boehner initially called for, a revote, they decided on how they could avoid a revote. And they decided to tie the Trade Adjustment Assistance to a vote on African trade, which is very popular with Democrats and the Black Caucus in particular. They thought by tying to that bill they could pass it. Now, they were not going to do that in the House because that would require another vote on the adjustment assistance. So here's what they're doing. They passed the Fast Track through the House with a bare 218-vote majority. Now that vote is going to the Senate, and the Senate will vote on that, and then they will vote separately on adding trade adjustment assistance to the Africa bill. Once that's added to the Africa bill, assuming that they win all these votes, if we win any of these votes, a really good chance we stop this whole thing. But right now it's looking pretty tough. But if they add that to the Africa bill, then the Africa bill goes back to the House, and the House votes on the Africa bill. Not on adjustment assistance, just on the full bill with that included. And so they avoid the vote that they seem to be unable to win. And if that all passes, then President Obama gets both the Fast Track and the TAA, and we'll sign them both, and we'll be stuck with 6 years of fast tracking of trade bills. So it's not just President Obama who gets that, but whoever the next president is, whether it's Marco Rubio or Scott Walker or Hillary Clinton, they will also have fast track and can push through all sorts of terrible trade agreements. And right now Obama has three massive trade agreements. Most people have heard of the Trans-Pacific Partnership right now. Like the others, TPP was negotiated in secret. The most important one, which WikiLeaks leaked some portions of, is TISA, which is the Trade and Services Agreement, which is probably the biggest and most dangerous of the three. So these are three massive deals. The third one is the European deal, which will rewrite the rules for trade internationally. It'll make our courts secondary because these WTO trade tribunals will decide issues of global trade, and our courts can't overturn those. And so it's a massive corporate power grab that will really give transnational corporations the dominant position in controlling how trade occurs throughout the world.
Yeah. Well, there are many things I don't understand about this whole deal, but start with that. Why are these trade agreements not treaties that have to have a two-thirds vote under the Constitution?
I think that's a critical question and one we also are concerned about. I think that the traditional trade agreements, you know, would be dealing with, you know, whether there's taxes on imports and tariffs and that kind of thing. These trade agreements are totally different from what they used to be. These cover every aspect of life. In my view, they really are treaties. And I think they only call them agreements in order to avoid the constitutional requirement for a two-thirds vote on a treaty. And I think they could never get a two-thirds vote, which is why they work to avoid calling it a treaty. My view is they legally are treaties. The question is, who has the power to bring that issue to court and raise it? I hope it does get raised, because I think if it does, all these trade agreements could be thrown out and found to be violating the treaty clause of the Constitution. That's not the only clause of the Constitution. That's not the only clause of the Constitution that I think is being violated, but that I think is a very significant one.
Right. And it absolutely puzzles me how these agreements, they're supposed to be kept secret for 4 years for the TPP and 5 years for the Trade and Services Agreement after the things have been signed. So I just don't understand that. How can that be in the first place? I mean, how are you not allowed to know the terms of something you've just been bound by?
It's just bizarre. And what makes that even more bizarre is that the fast-track bill that they are trying to push through Congress includes in it that we get to see the contents of the trade agreement before it's voting on for 60 days. How do we get to see it if it's supposed to be kept secret for 4 years or 5 years, mm-hmm. depending on the bill? I mean, so it's depending on the treaty. So it's really a very strange concept. The whole concept of secretly negotiated treaties rushed through Congress by fast track and then secret law seems so opposite of democracy, where the people are supposed to rule. How can we rule if we don't know what is being voted on or being negotiated on our behalf that affect every aspect of our life, from food and health care to banking regulation, to the internet access? I mean, every aspect of our life really is affected by this, and yet it's all being done in secret, with secret law. It's mm-hmm. bizarre.
And the fact that you could give that kind of authority for deals that haven't even been done yet. I mean, they're years in the future. You have no idea what are in these deals. They are allowed to be secret right until they go to Congress. I just wrote an article, and you know, quoting the Wizard of Oz, because it just seems so. I mean, sorry, the Alice in Wonderland, because it seems so like that whole kangaroo court of the Queen of Hearts, where
exactly.
it's completely arbitrary. They win no matter what, and so there are many provisions in there that I also think are shocking, like the ISDS provisions. I know they've had those for a long time. The investor state dispute settlement provisions.
Yeah, that's another provision that I think is unconstitutional, because basically Article 3 of the Constitution deals with the courts. It does not allow for courts that are to be created by the executive branch. And that's basically what's happening here. The executive branch is negotiating these treaties that creates this whole new court system, where corporations can sue governments for the profits they expected to make before a law is passed in the public interest, a law to protect the environment or to regulate the banks or to, uplift workers, protect workers, ensure equal access to the Internet, whatever the law is. If it undermines profits, they can now sue in these rigged trade tribunals. I call them rigged because they are done in secret. The judges are often lawyers who are corporate lawyers that just leave their corporate job temporarily to serve as judges. They make their rulings and they go back to their job with the corporation. So you have biased judges in secret courts making decisions that our courts cannot review, that the U.S. Supreme
Right.
Court cannot review. So that seems to be totally in violation of Article 3 of the Constitution to create a court system that can't be reviewed by our courts.
Right. It almost looks like the whole point is to destroy what our Constitution, our democracy, our Republican form of government, the balance of powers, the rule of law, that the whole idea of having laws is that we we all agree to them and through certain procedures, and now they're just thrown out the procedures. The whole fast track idea baffles the mind. I mean, why would anybody agree to that? They must all be either bribed or pressured in some way.
And well, in fact, a report came out that almost $200 million has been donated to members of the U.S. House of Representatives during the time of the fast-track debate, at least for the first 3 months of it. And John Boehner, the one pushing this most aggressively, received over $5 million in donations from transnational corporate interests during that time period. But almost $200 million was provided. So bribed is a good word. We have a very corrupt Congress, very corrupt government up to the presidency. President Obama needs to raise $500 million for his three presidential libraries and centers in New York, Hawaii, and the main one in Chicago. So he needs to have access to lots of money to make those three centers happen. And so, yes, money, I think, is the key factor. It's really a classic fight between money and the people. As I said, there were hundreds of thousands of phone calls made to Congress for the last few weeks, and the people were really up in arms and angry. And as a result, Congress voted with us. But then Boehner, McConnell, and Obama manipulated the system, created revotes, and have done a job of undermining that initial vote and undermining the people's will. And so, yes, I'm not sure if I'd say the intention of these agreements is to undermine democracy, et cetera, but the intention of these agreements is to make massive profits. I'm talking trillions of dollars in profits for transnational corporate interests. So they can give $200 million. That's a great investment. You're going to make trillions of dollars, and that's what's going to happen. It's also a massive shift of power to corporate interests away from the nation states, away from sovereign countries, and from our own sovereignty as people. But the real intent is big money for big business at the expense of everybody else and at the expense of the environment.
Mm-hmm. And under the Trade and Services Agreement, once you privatize, I mean, it's all about harmonizing regulations, which means it'll be like a race to the bottom, which means total
right.
liberalization. Whoever's got the most liberal, loosest laws, that'll become the law. And then once you do that, or even let's say you experiment with privatizing some public utility, you can't go back. You can't go back
That's
to
right.
having it be a public utility.
It's a one-way street. Yeah, it's a one-way street to privatization. The Trade and Services Agreement, I think, will be the most dangerous of the three agreements. It covers 50 nations. Services is a very broad category. It covers 80% of the U.S. economy. Services include things like the Postal Service or education services. It includes things like financial services, health services. It includes accounting services, lawyers' services. It covers 80% of the economy. So you can imagine it's a massive agreement, have a big impact. And it basically, the basic agenda of the Trade and Services Agreement, according to the leaks that we've seen from WikiLeaks, is to privatize everything and make everything into a commodity, deregulate as much as possible, and create a one-way street toward a privatization. Now, you can't go back once, for example, the Postal Service. Right now it's the most popular public good, public service in the nation. It's a great bargain for people compared to the privatized Federal Express and UPS. And the goal of these peace agreements would be to privatize the Postal Service, which is something that is already being pressured in the United States, but they've been unable to do it. So you privatize the Postal Service, it's a one-way ticket. You cannot go back to being public. And that would be the same would be true with the public utility. The same would be true with the municipal ownership of Internet access. And if you try to set up a municipal ownership of Internet access, the TISA will make it difficult. They'll allow for the Comcast to come in and challenge you. And, of course, then that those horrible trade tribunals are in the background to try to enforce anything that the big business interests want. So, yeah, TISA, I think, is the most dangerous and least discussed. It's been negotiated now for 2 years, if fast track passes, that's how they'll try to get this through Congress. If fast track passes, we're not giving up. I mean, we will move our efforts to stopping the TPP, stopping the European agreement, stopping TISA and whatever else comes along. But it's a much harder fight to go against individual agreements than it is to just stop fast track and force the doors to be open so all of us to see what's inside.
And why is fast track so important to them to get it passed? I know they want to do it quickly. Go ahead.
Well, it all comes down to secrecy. These trade agreements are already very unpopular because people remember the experience and the impact of NAFTA on wide regions of our economy, wide geographic areas of especially the Midwest and the what was now called the Rust Belt, used to be the Industrial Belt. People remember the impact. And the reason they keep these secrets is because if people knew what was inside them, they would never become law. And so they can negotiate these in secret for 6 years, keep them secret after they're negotiated, and then Fast Track allows for them to go to Congress and be rushed through Congress with very little time for us to review the thousands of pages of legalese that has come out of 6 years of negotiations, and to organize people to stop it. And so and Congress is not allowed to hold hearings on the bills. They just go right to the floor of the House and the Senate where they're voted up or down with no amendments. And so it really cuts out a lot of the congressional process that would have allowed people to know what's in these bills and organize and mobilize to stop these agreements from becoming law. But now if they pass Fast Track, they have continued the secrecy, the virtual secrecy of the process they've done for negotiations as well.
And it appears, I mean, their justification for secrecy is it's like it's national security, as if for some reason that this is going to give us a leg up against China, which is taking over theoretically it's a threat to the global economy. But it doesn't seem to me that this actually would help us as against China, which is not part of the agreement. And, I mean, that just seems like a cover. But anyway, why should we be competing with China anyway? We should be joining other countries, it seems to me, in trade. Anyway, what's your thought on this whole China argument?
Well, this is part of being the largest empire in world history, an empire that is secret to most Americans, never discussed in the media that we are an empire, never discussed by members of Congress that we're an empire, and, of course, never discussed by the president that we are in an empire and that the president is commander-in-chief of the largest empire in world history. Of course, we're in the process of shifting our military to Asia to surround China. We're negotiating all sorts of agreements with Asian countries, Australia, New Zealand, Japan, the Philippines, South Korea, Malaysia, Vietnam, and others, and doing all sorts of war games to mimic attacks on China or on North Korea. And so we're building up our military infrastructure, and the Asian pivot is central to that strategy. The TPP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, is the economic arm of the Asia pivot, and China is not included, as you mentioned. And so it's an effort to cut China off from its neighbors. TISA, by the way, the Trade and Services Agreement, does not include any of the BRICS countries, Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa. And so it's an attempt by democracies, so-called democracies, controlled by corporate power, to put their laws in place globally and keeping the BRICS companies out. I think we'd be much better off in a cooperative rather than competitive relationship with China. The Chinese economy has helped to prop up the global economy, especially after the 2008 collapse. And this approach of trying to isolate China and weaken it economically is going to, in the end, backfire and weaken all of us economically. It's a gigantic error, an error upon an error, and that's the price of empire. And I think especially the price of an empire that's a fading empire that can't win a war, and only dominates by brute force in both the military, political, and economic realm. And they fear losing that power, but instead they should confront the reality of a world where there are a variety of powers, and we should learn to cooperate and work together to build the world economy rather than compete so that only a few can profit from the world economy. It's a gigantic error.
Right, and I think most people feel that way, that we want to cooperate. It's that, but somehow we've got this media that makes us feel like that we should be at war with China instead of cooperating. Anyway, it seems to me that what the good thing that might be coming out of this is just that, you have managed to mobilize a huge force, and people in general are just becoming more and more aware of this huge corporate monster that's being imposed on us and that's taking away our rights. Maybe, arguably, at some point we'll actually have a revolution, not a violent revolution, but maybe we'll mobilize enough people to understand what's going on. I mean, the first thing you have to do is understand, and most people don't, because most people watch ordinary TV for their news. But anyway, what's your thought on that?
This is the largest coalition against these corporate trade agreements, these global corporate trade agreements, has ever been developed. And it, as I said, it's been a populist uprising the last 2 weeks in Congress. The unions have done a great job. The environmental groups have done a great job. Food and water groups, GMO groups, internet activists, groups like us and Public Citizen that deal with a whole range of issues. It's been an amazing coalition. I think the key is that if we lose this fight, we need to keep this coalition together, and people need to understand that we had a lot of power, that we did have a big impact. We really slowed them down, made it much harder, and if we stay together and keep working together, we can build even more power. So I think that's the key, is where do we go from here? And so I think it's important for us to focus this coalition on each of these individual treaties, perhaps find ways to get the issues of the legality of the trade tribunals and the idea of this being a treaty into court so it can be challenged. We may have to pursue that path. But we need to keep this coalition together. This movement of movements can have an impact. We saw it during the net neutrality fight, where we were able to ensure that there's equal access to the internet for all with no discrimination based on money. And we're still fighting that battle, but we won that so far we're winning that battle. And I think that it shows that people power can win, but we need to work together in a coalition that allows for each group to push their agenda as part of that coalition effort. So that would be a great thing. If it comes out of this, that we have a movement of movements that continues to work together, we can have a tremendous impact on not only trade agreements, but lots of other issues.
Yeah, that'd be great. So this is Monday that we're pre-recording, and this show doesn't play till Wednesday, so we have to assume both outcomes, I guess. So what are your next steps, assuming the worst?
Well, if we win this, it'll be a tremendous victory of people over money. It's a long odds victory. The odds were never in our favor, and so if we win this, it'd be a tremendous boost of people defeating transnational corporate interests. If we don't win this, we will have shown how they have to manipulate their own system to pass laws that the people don't want, how they are willing to manipulate the way Congress operates in order to pass laws the people have spoken out strongly against. And we'll also have unveiled the corruption with the hundreds of millions of dollars that have been distributed by these corporate interests in order to get this kind of legislation that the people don't want through. So we will, either way, we will have accomplished a great deal. And as I said, the next steps would be to focus on the individual treaties, protecting our victory on net neutrality, and then the other issues that unite us all are the impact of climate chaos that is starting to have its be felt around the nation and the globe. And that affects every aspect of life again. So it's another reason for us to organize people to become part of a movement of movements. And then we need to find ways to keep building that concept of how issues are all connected, and how we can work together to really make a difference on issue after issue after issue. And we've got to also make sure part of that is showing the anger of the people. If we fail in this, I think that would be the one weakness we showed. Where we did have some protests, we did interrupt some hearings, we should have done a lot more of that and really created fear in the power structure that they allowed this to go through, that there would be a mass revolt. And we were not able to make that point. I think if we fail, that would be, in my view, the first reason why.
Yeah, for me, of course, my big issue is public banking. And it does, the BRICS, Brazil, Russia, India, China, South Africa, they actually, even though they may be part of the Bank for International Settlements, but they actually are tending toward not being part of this big global central banking system. It seems to me that that may be one of the major underlying secret agendas here, is to get everybody subscribing to one big privatized banking system where they issue the money and we have to borrow it from them rather than allowing us to issue our own. Yeah, but I agree with that the only way we're going to win is to combine all these movements, because at the moment you've got a little movement here, a little movement there, and nobody has enough power to. And then even within things like the monetary reform movement, you have people who disagree on what the best solution is and so forth. So that's a really tricky thing, is how you have a united front while you still may disagree on certain fine points of all these issues. I was in the alternative healthcare movement in the 90s, and you had all these mavericks who were brilliant in their way, but they all shot each other down because they all thought the others were quacks.
So, yeah. Sometimes you can't tell where those divisions are put on top of us by the power structure, and so we have to be careful about that. I think public banking is such an obvious no-brainer of the way we should be doing banking, at least a key part of it, that it's hard to understand why people would oppose it. So I think we need to watch out for those that do, because it doesn't make any sense to continue to support these Wall Street banks while not pushing forward, you know, public banking where the people actually have greater control of their economic destiny rather than Wall Street determining it for us. So I think that's a key issue. And banking is certainly central to all of these questions of U.S. empire and imperialism and militarism, of climate change, of even net neutrality and healthcare. You know, Obama showed himself when he put the healthcare bill through. He did. It was basically a Wall Street healthcare bill designed for investors in pharmaceutical companies and for-profit hospitals and, of course, the insurance industry, not really designed for the people. And so he really showed himself when he did that. And he showed himself to be an excellent salesman. You could call it a scam artist, because I think that was one of the greatest scams. There are still people who have such partisan glasses on, they can't see that they were victimized by a scam that is going to increase healthcare costs, increase premiums as well as out-of-pocket costs, and not really solve the basic problems of inequality in healthcare, in fact, make them worse. So the most successful scam is when people thought they got a great deal. Some people still think they got a great deal and haven't figured out yet they've been scammed. And I think Obama's a great salesman on that, and he's doing the same thing. He's trying to do the same thing with these trade agreements, and I hope we can stop him.
Yeah, well, I'm behind you all the way. I know you're super busy, and I don't want to hold you up,
yeah.
But
right.
I do want to say thanks from all of us for all your work that you've done on this and exposing the issue and pushing the issue and showing your anger, showing your resistance. That's all great. Do you want to name any websites or tell people what they
sure.
can do?
Yeah, sure. I mean, obviously the best site that connects all of our work is popularresistance.org, and that you'll see Flush the TPP is the trade campaign. That's one of the ones that we connect there, but it covers all our issues. If people really want to stay involved in what the movement is doing, I think the best thing we provide for that is our daily newsletter. You can sign up on the top left of the page. The daily news summary comes out in the morning. So it's kind of like your coffee and breakfast reading of what the movement is up to, what issues are concerned the movement's about. 10 to 20 articles with a one-paragraph summary. You can click on it to get more details, but you can sign up for that at popularresistance.org. And we do a weekly analysis as well, which you can sign up for as well, which is more of an analysis of the trends of the movement and what lessons we can take from the last week or two of actions the movement has been involved in. So with those two coming to your mail, I think you'll be really well informed about what's happening in the movement of movements on a wide variety of fronts, from Black Lives Matter, you know, to the health care, to housing, to poverty, to trade agreements, militarism, and war. We try to cover all those fronts of struggle. So please join us. Get involved. We need people to get educated and mobilized and to do the same educating and mobilizing others. It's going to take all of us to make this a success. And thank you for your work, Ellen. You do great work as well. Thank you for everything you do.
Likewise. Okay, great. Thanks for doing it.
Okay.
I've been speaking with Kevin Zeese of the group Popular Resistance and a leader in the Stop Fast Track Coalition.
This has been a remarkable week. A couple of days ago, we had this bright hope that the voice of the people was spoken powerfully and won the day. And then within a matter of hours, literally just hours, it's all taken away. through some stratagem, some circuitous sort of a little technicality, and here we are facing this monstrous, illegal, unconstitutional violation of our rights and our interests by the oligarchy that owns us, basically, at this point, as we all know. And now where does this leave us? You're talking about the TPP. That's what we're talking about. Because it is the window, it seems, to the control of corporations over our prospects and our rights and our ability to manage ourselves. We started the show with, for Howard Beale, a guy who was angry and fed up, had had enough, seen the writing on the wall. Seems to me that's where we're at. And yet, I know you've found some hopefulness in it, Ellen.
Well, I guess the hopefulness would be that never let a good crisis go to waste, as Churchill said. Or, in other words, it's when things fall apart that they actually change, when you go over the edge, when people finally realize that nothing we can do is going to work. In other words, neither party is actually for us. Neither one is the party of the people. We need either a new party. I'm not sure that would work either. But we need a movement, and it seems to me we've got the impetus. It's started. Obviously, we don't have the 5% that you need yet to actually change things, but we've got a lot of people that are quite up in arms, as you say. And if we can sort of bury our differences over details and be a united front, we could be very powerful. You can see that happening in Europe, where many people are upset with this whole anti-austerity movement, and it's not just in Greece, it's in England, and of course there are a number of countries that are far more indebted than Greece is. So,
and in Greece we see this inspiring exercise of populist democracy, as it were, at least being expressed through a group that is trying to take on the most powerful global financial interests, and they're willing to take it to the line. Is that where we're going to go in America, do you think, up against the banks? It's going to be the people and the banks?
It's definitely the banks is where the control point is. That's what happened to Greece. The Tsipras party got in, and immediately what happened was that the ECB cut off their funding. All banks, as we now know, basically don't have the money. I mean, they're all effectively insolvent because they're all just creating credit on their books, and then they're counting on getting the liquidity from somewhere else to back up these loans that they make, and that's where they get their money. So they want to be making loans. So that's the way all banking works. So as soon as the Tsipras party got in, they hadn't done anything wrong. The ECB put them on this emergency funding thing. So they don't have the money. I mean, they've cut them off from all their bailout money. They've had to make way more concessions than they intended to make. But so they're valiantly, not exactly towing the line, but they're valiantly holding out.
If Greece decides that they really don't want to play anymore and they're not going to pay this big bill, and you're suggesting that it needs to be a matter of convincing the populace of Greece to go along with that, but if they can't pay their bills, aren't they going to be obligated to create a new financial or currency structure?
Yeah, well, I think that's what it'll come to. The Greek people don't want austerity either. So when they realize that there are no concessions are going to be made, then arguably, they'll agree. They're now made a deal with Russia.
The Russian Chinese Bank, the new central bank.
Is what they should do. But I think the main problem is persuading the Greek people that that's what they want to do. And that's pretty much supposedly the excuse for all this secrecy and rushing through the TPP with no mention even of the trade and services agreement and, you know, things that we don't even know about yet that are coming down the pike. But the whole reason for rushing it through supposedly is it gives us leverage in the world market as against China, because China is winning the war for world markets. But why is it a war? We should not be considering them. It's not like a military thing where you're competing over world markets. Cooperation, we know from animal studies, cooperation works better than competition. What we're tending toward is one big organism, it seems to me. We need to have one universal economy that works together and not competes for resources.
And it's the only model that is sustainable and that has any prospect of success. We've really worn through the capitalist evolution to the point where it has now disabled itself. Everybody, I think, sees it, and most people are feeling it in terms of not having the resources to get on with their lives, so much so that even the Pope would say, look, this thing is collapsing. We have to be more responsible and attentive to who we are as human beings with money to make choices and outcomes. What do you think the interjection of the Pope's commentary about finance and economies will do ultimately? What, you know, how does that help us in our own evolutionary process?
Well, the Pope is not actually an economist. You know, I've heard criticisms. He's not an economist, that you don't turn to your Pope for investment advice. But the fact that he's coming out and saying that is that many people do look to the Pope for guidance. And so
Right. It's
certainly encouraging for a movement, a movement away from this huge privatization monster. I mean, it seems to me that we've worn through the model of putting self first, sort of the self first model, that it's all about me and my profits as against you and your profits, which is a competitive model. I mean, there's something to be said for competition, but it needs to be competition within, you know, a cooperative teamwork sort of thing. Like the way the Japanese do it, they're very competitive, but they're competitive in a cooperative way.
The thing about the Pope's interjection in this global dynasty of power, that he speaks to the essential aspect of a public economy, which has to do with relationship. What he was saying is that money is a relationship. It's a moral and ethical and societal relationship. It's not just a commodity. It's something that has to do with our commitment to one another and how we're going to interact. So he brings up all these value-based factors that he says that we should be focusing on instead of fattening our nests and, you know, building our wallets out. For me, I think that's a big shift.
Money has been imposed on us. It's sort of a control mechanism, as if there's only a limited amount of money, when in fact, as the Pope says, it's actually a relationship. So there's no limit to the amount of money you can create. Money is just an agreement between, you know, it's a credit and debit situation. All money is credit. We now know that banks create virtually the entire money supply. They create it as debt or credit, just writing it into account. So it's like a big community currency system. You can have as much community currency as you say a digital system, let's say. That's actually the way our banking system works, that somebody goes to the bank, wants to take out a loan, and that loan, that credit that is created, is how the money supply expands. That's why we only have $1 trillion in physical money and $10 trillion in the money supply.
Well, when the decision came down that allowed the TPP process to continue, I was frankly very angry. Aren't we not, you know, we're at a point that seems to me to be very pivotal of whether or not we're able to retain and control any of our ability as a republic to influence public policy and to influence our future. It seems that they're really tightening the screws around us. And this is a very difficult time for us to see this go down. I think one of the things that you said with Kevin, our guest this week, is that there's some hope that comes out of the fact that with this reality, people will get how really screwed they are, to use the term, you know, that there isn't much hope for their prospect to get out of this, and that we will align.
Well, Americans are not suffering enough for getting to the streets. But I think people are definitely waking up, and that's what it takes for people to unglue themselves from their TVs, which are giving the party line and are not giving the true story, and to start. Once you become suspicious, you know, then it actually becomes really interesting. You really want to know what's really happening, and suddenly you start looking around, and then suddenly there's this whole new world of information that takes on meaning for you. So hopefully more and more people will come to that place where they're ready to get out there and mobilize and do something.
Well, we'll see what happens, and we'll be here to cover it, or at least to interpret it. Ellen, thank you very much.
Okay, and thank you.
Wells Fargo, diversity, and economic justice. What kind of world do we make when we leave social justice up to the big banks? I'm Matt Stannard with your public banking report. Religious conservatives are up in arms about a recent Wells Fargo commercial featuring a same-sex female couple meeting their new adopted daughter. Wells Fargo has admirably refused to pull the ad in the face of intimidation and threats of boycott and divestment by the evangelical conservative community. This seems like good corporate citizenship in favor of diversity, and it is. And Wells Fargo's doing some other things, too. They have played a role in the promotion of economic development in many of our nation's large cities by joining with the U.S. Conference of Mayors in the implementation of a Community Wins grant program that the Wells Fargo Foundation has funded. Ironically, one of the resolutions rejected at this year's Mayor's Conference would have condemned big banks like Wells Fargo for charging excessive financing costs on municipalities, costs that hurt cities and the businesses that fill them far more than any philanthropic actions can make up for. This is the paradox of corporate philanthropy and support for diversity. Wells Fargo will undoubtedly benefit from its stance on LGBT relations and the PR dividend of its community partnership programs. But neither of those endeavors will pay social benefits that outweigh what Wells Fargo and the industry it upholds has cost communities. The company is one of those named in the recent groundbreaking Dirty Deals report, tracking Wall Street's predatory handling of municipal finance. Specifically, Wells Fargo has been implicated in the shortchanging of public education funding, part of the overall trend by big banks to charge debilitating fees to manage public funds, our own money. It doesn't even come close to ending there. The DC Public Banking Group has assembled a list of damning facts about Wells Fargo, including lawsuits for steering blacks and Latinos into high-cost subprime mortgage loans, a HUD investigation for the same, a settlement with the Justice Department for the same, a profiteering fine in 2010, an SEC fine for risky mortgage-backed securities sold in 2007, and a fraud lawsuit by the Federal Housing Administration in 2012. The company has been implicated in mortgage robo-signing, interest rate swaps that have killed municipal finance, and even in money laundering for drug gangs. Wells Fargo has as many as 18 offshore tax havens. Now, to make up for these pockmarks, Wells Fargo is promoting diversity and economic development. But as CorpWatch reports, Wells Fargo & Company scores high on workplace diversity, but has been accused of mistreating its poorer customers, many of whom are people of color. The company has been charged with a slew of abusive practices, such as charging higher interest rates than a borrower's credit warrants and imposing excessive mortgage origination fees. Environmental activists have also charged the bank with financing environmentally destructive infrastructure projects in developing countries. Disregard for the rule of law, rejection of transparency, an astronomically high CEO pay, for example, the $19.3 million a year Wells Fargo's CEO makes, all of those things are indicative of a financial culture of aloofness that neither understands nor cares about the struggles of the working class. Philanthropy devoted to limited, carefully tailored economic development and commitments to identity-based rather than economic diversity demonstrate a symbolic attempt to prove a kind of a social trickle-down effect that fabulously wealthy corporations and big private finance will pay a social dividend. But no social dividend paid by the big banks makes up for what they do to people and communities, the legal stuff, let alone the illegal stuff. The high interest rates, the finance fees, those alone are wrecking cities, contributing to poverty, crime, domestic violence, and police brutality. And moreover, if trade deals like the TPP become reality, fast-tracked, anti-democratic, anti-transparency deals that allow multinational corporations to whittle away at public options under the guise of objecting to anti-competitive practices, then big banks will increasingly have the power to determine social outcomes, whether those are identity-based, civil rights, or economic justice outcomes. There's no reason to believe that a banking corporation that engages in criminal fraud, legal extortion, community wrecking, and anti-labor practices or racist predatory lending will consistently hold a decent line on LGBT or other civil rights issues. And in any event, injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere. So while we should celebrate Wells Fargo's refusal to bow down to religious conservatives on LGBT issues, we also need to ask how many millions of people of all sexual orientations, genders, and ethnicities are hurt by the company's actual banking, financial, and employment practices. More importantly, we should think about how much better off we'll all be, what infinitely better shape we'll be in to solve all sorts of identity-based oppression when democratically run, publicly owned financial institutions are implemented all over the nation. After all, it's our money. I'm Matt Stannard. Have a good week.
We mentioned Pope Francis's recent encyclical earlier in the program, and while we don't have time to examine that in detail, one of the recent developments within the New Economy movement reflects the shift in values that the Pope speaks of. It's called the Empathy Surplus Project, an effort to bring morality into all languaging and conversation that deals with public policy, including money and banking. We spoke with Empathy Surplus Project co-founder Chuck Watts, an investment advisor and retired Episcopalian priest, about what the Empathy Surplus Project brings to the table.
The Empathy Surplus Project is co-founded by myself, a lifelong Democrat, and my friend Gary Evans, a lifelong Republican. And the premise is that if you believe that empathy and responsibility for yourself and for others should be in public government at all levels, people who share those beliefs ought to be able to get in the same room and have a conversation about how to govern with those values. So our focus is how to build trust for effective governance around those core values of empathy, responsibility, and strength, and begin to practice the relatively new cognitive science out there on political speech. So we're focused on inwardly digesting those new insights. How do you use those new insights? Because all language is linked to frames that cognitive science call frames. And language is not neutral. It's moral. All conversations are moral conversations. And so we're about helping people get better at talking about what we want from a moral point of view.
And so isn't that what the Pope then is also doing, is bringing into the global conversation about the inherent problems with market-based priorities? He is bringing a theological notion into an economic practice.
Well, you know, actually, my understanding of the word economy is an ancient word that literally means a household. And so at the very basic form, economy is how we care for one another. You know, it starts in our families. And so it's not a new thing.
Yeah, his indictment of the global market economy, he says it's plundering the earth at the expense of the poor and of future generations.
Yes.
He says the earth, you know, our home is beginning to look more and more like an immense pile of filth. Lovely language to describe the truth. At least his assessment of how we're positioned here. What is it about empathy that you think would make a change in our economic foundations?
Great question. Appreciate your asking. And for me, empathy at its roots, you know, my mom and dad always said, you know, try to put yourself in the other person's shoes. The reason I'm focused on empathy is because in 2004, I read a book that changed my life, and the book is entitled Don't Think of an Elephant by Dr. George Lakoff, a cognitive scientist in Berkeley. In that book, he talked about how the brain works and how common sense is created. And one of the things that grabbed me the most was that whenever we're talking to one another, you know, whether you agree with the other person or not, the words of the other person are activating particular places in your brain. And so, for example, money, if you just talk about money and you don't clarify what you're talking about, it quite often activates the area of the brain that causes fear, because we're always wondering whether or not we have enough of it. If you talk about empathy and care, that has a particular place in your brain that is activated. And one of the things that Lakoff talked about in that first book was in 1971, Lewis Powell, in what's now known as the Powell Manifesto, challenged corporations to start spending money on getting our way of thinking into the American mind. Our way of thinking for Lewis Powell was, how do we inhibit the values of empathy and responsibility for others?
I see. So you're saying that there was at some point a directive or perhaps an advisory that if we're going to create a successful, profitable market, we need to have people not be empathetic.
That's exactly right.
Uh-huh.
We want a world where you're only concerned about yourself. And Lewis Powell, that directive that went out, his memo, was taken to heart. And there were dozens of think tanks about how do we get our particular values in everywhere. How do we buy TV stations, radio stations? How do we buy the media, newspapers? How do we endow chairs at colleges so that we can get our message? And the message is according to Lakoff, and I tend to believe him, are centered around three core values. And those values are authority, obedience, and discipline, mostly the authority of the market, the invisible hand. And if you focus on profit, on your own profit, nobody else's profit, and if everybody does that, you'll be rich, everybody will be rich. And you don't have to think about anybody else. That's what's going on.
So the Empathy Surplus Project, then, is bringing into the conversation about creating a new economy, a whole taxonomy of language in which we start with, a principle of empathy, and then let our systems reflect those values. Is that a fair assessment?
That's a great assessment. And so when you link that word, care, caring, to society, to economy, to citizenship, you are activating the prefrontal cortex of everyone's brain. And we need to be using that language when we talk about money. We don't want just a public bank. We want a caring public bank. You know, we want a bank that cares for, its neighbors.
That's Chuck Watts, co-founder of the Empathy Surplus Project at empathysurplus.com. That does it for this edition of It's Our Money with Ellen Brown. If you'd like to stay current with Ellen's writing and commentary, visit ellenbrown.com. And if you'd like to know more about public banking and related developments around the country, please visit publicbankinginstitute.org. Visit them on Facebook and follow on Twitter at Public Banks Now. Our thanks to our guests today, and especially to our committed sponsors at Payment Management Merchant Credit Card Services, dedicated to economic justice and fairness and the creation of new American public banks. Payment Management offers complimentary analysis of your current credit card needs and expenses at paymentmgmt.com. For Ellen Brown, I'm Walt McCree. Thanks for listening, and see you next time on It's Our Money with Ellen Brown.